C2PR. Number 19A.
Continue, and we come to the last tone of principle as love. We had a long discussion on two subtones, so we just remind ourselves where we are. We are in the tone of principle, the prayer of principle. It's a prayer of honesty. The prayer of honesty is a prayer of conformity of what? At the point of mind, it's showing the conformity of words with desire, that they conform. In spirit, we had the conformity of the inward and the outward, that the inward attitude and the outward expression conforms. In the tone of soul, we had that conformity where we are honest about ourselves and see, are we regarding ourselves really as what we actually are, or do we fool ourselves about ourselves? So it's a great sense of self-examination, what we are, who we are. Then we came to principle as principle, where she showed the conformity of theory and practice, of theory and proof. And then to life, where it showed, is there a conformity between really the intention of going the way and actually going the way? Is there conformity with going the way of life and therefore laying down the mortal sense of life? Does that conform? Is there conformity of going the way and being willing to pay the price of it? And then in truth we saw that there is that conformity of asking aright and going to the right source for prayer. Do we go to the source of God to pray or not? If we go to the source of God, then our prayer is right and we don't ask amiss. And now in the last tone we see another conformity, namely that there is conformity of prayer with the principle of prayer, which demands that our prayer is such that we are willing to correct everything that is not in line with principle, so that we correct the mistake and don't ask for pardon. That there is no conformity between between praying and asking for pardon, but much more that conformity between praying and correcting what needs to be corrected. So that is then the security we have, that we do not repeat the offense. Now this we will see quickly in reading the last two paragraphs and see that they all have to do with correcting that sense that we ask for pardon instead that we correct a mistake. So she takes up the subject first from the legal point of view, from the magistrate point of view, then afterwards from the point of view of moral law, then afterwards she takes up from the point of view of science and shows those three different aspects. Let us see what she says. So she starts out and says a magistrate, so we know it's a legal law, a legal handling of the situation, sometimes remits the penalty. So it's about penalty. But this may be no moral benefit to the criminal. And at best, it only saves the criminal from one form of punishment. So the subject is, what about a penalty? What about remitting the penalty? Is that right to remit the penalty? Or how should he look at it? So she says, a magistrate, therefore a personal sense of it, he can either remit the penalty or not. But even by remitting the penalty, he doesn't really do a good job. It may be morally worse, because the criminal may repeat the offence and thinks, next time I get away with it anyhow again, so it doesn't really matter. So it shows that remitting a penalty without correction is not right. The side note also is remission of penalty. Well, you know that penalty is the opposite of love. Huh? Then she takes up the moral law against the legal law. The moral law, which has the right to acquit or condemn, always demands restitution before mortals can go up higher. So the moral law demands something more. It demands restitution before mortals can go up higher. Again, it's a better sense than the legal law. It takes the right to say, I either condemn or I acquit, as if they would be God Almighty to say what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad. So again, this is not really a true sense of remitting the penalty. Then we come to another kind, just to broken law, how she brings it away from legal law and from moral law, just to the very fact of a law, whatever that law is. And we know that if we break a law in physics, in chemistry, in every field of activity, that broken law brings penalty. We can't help that. In order to compel this progress, why does it compel progress? Because that's the old classical way of research, that we investigate a new subject by trial and error. We learn something if we do the thing right, and we learn something if we do the thing wrongly. Because from what we do wrong, we will find out what we did wrong, and therefore have gained something. It brings us higher. It compels progress. That's what happens in a laboratory, in chemistry, and so you try and try. By trial and error, you find out something new. So that's a scientific law. Under scientific law, I mean a law in the fields of sciences, that there it is an absolutely natural thing that if we break a law, that it doesn't work, that we get the penalty, that the experiment doesn't bring a result. So having taken these three kinds of laws, she now goes then afterwards to the true law. So she says in 12, mere legal pardon. So she refers back to, really, to line 5 and 6. Huh? The magistrate can pardon, can remit the penalty. So mere legal pardon, and then in bracket, and there is no other pardon, but only a legal pardon. For divine principle never pardons. Do you hear now principle? We are in the tone of principle. Principle never pardons. People pardon. Moral law can pardon. But law itself can never pardon. Law, broken law, brings penalty. And for that, there is no pardon. So there is no a pardon in principle. Now we have to read that again. It's a long sentence. Oh, yeah. So let's first read what is within the brackets. And there is no other pardon For divine principle never pardons our sins or mistakes till they are corrected. See, this is now the point. If there is a pardoning principle, then it is that pardon which says you correct it. So correction is actually then the pardon, but it's no more a pardon actually. Because pardon is if you don't have to do a thing. You are just forgiven. As now we read that which is outside the brackets. Mere legal pardon leaves the offender free to repeat the offense. If indeed he has not already suffered sufficiently from vice to make him turn from it with loathing. Again, we can see, as above, that somehow a broken law has also something good in it. It brings penalty, but that's not the end of it. Penalty says, this is very uncomfortable, and I better don't break the law again in the future. So we win something. Just as it says here, until we have suffered sufficiently to make him turn from it with loathing. So something is gained. Huh? Well, you know, that gives the sense of love. Because love, Mrs. Eddy describes as that which forces us to give up evil and which wants us to save, to be saved. Love forces salvation. Love is not so that it says, if you don't do right, well, that's your business. That's not my business. So have it. Love says, no, if you don't do right, if you don't understand God, if you don't go along the way of life, I don't leave you. I force you to that nth degree until you yield, until you bend your knees, until you bend your neck, and you are willing to turn to the right. That's love. So we get here that forcible love. Love forces you to accept what best promotes your growth, she says, you see. And so we can see that she does that, as we have seen in the other prayer, either through understanding or through suffering. But still it's love behind it. Love forces you. Even if you break the law, there is still that love there which says, oh, I can use that situation very well to save you. I just bring you in such, I corner you so long until you can't get out any more of your corner. And then you have to give in. Then you have to turn. So that's love. That's not something bad, huh? That's the nature of love, the law of love. So she goes on and says, truth bestows no pardon upon error. Again, no pardon. Principle doesn't pardon, truth bestows no pardon upon error, but wipes it out in the most effectual manner. So again we see there is a terrific force at work. The Father knows what you need. And if you need the whip, he will give you the whips. And he will be a real slave driver. Love will use those methods that are adapted to any situation. That's why we always say to every situation we should be able to say thank you. And not resist it. If you really would have that sense that only love is ever going on, then whatever comes along our way and crosses our path, no matter if it seems to be very awkward, still we should get into that habit and say, oh, there's something good in it. There's something wonderful in it. If there wouldn't, then we would have duality, then God would no more be love. Because love wants us to save, and love is all, and error is nothing. So in every situation, there is the hand of love in it. So she brings that out here. Jesus suffered for our sins not to annul the divine sentence for an individual sin. So he didn't suffer to pardon us so that we can individually go on sinning and sinning as we like, but he suffered because sin brings inevitable suffering. That's the law. That breaking the law, that sin brings suffering. And now this is a very crucial theological point. Why should he suffer for us? If he was right, he shouldn't suffer for us. We should suffer if we do wrong. And the world can do wrong, and therefore the world can suffer, but why should he suffer? But he always said that he takes the sin of the world upon him. And that is a tricky point which we have to see clearly, because in a way we don't like to suffer for the world. That's one thing we have to work out, that the world can do all the wrongs in the world, but it shouldn't touch us. But that means that we grow to that stature which Jesus had, that he could really take upon him the sins of the world and not break, but be resurrected. Namely, that he could see that he is not only an individual, not only a collective of the Jews or the Christians, but also a universal idea. And the moment we span our consciousness more and more from the individual, where we say, well, I only have to account for my individual acts. If I do something wrong, it's all right that I get punished. But if the other fellow does something wrong, that has nothing to do with me. I'm not getting punished for that. That's his business. But that is only as long as we think we are an individual. The more we grow and see what Jesus saw, that he said, I'm not only the individuality of life, I'm also the collectivity of truth, and I'm also the universality of love, he jolly well had to take the sins of the world on his shoulder and work that out. And work that out. And this is a big, big question of today, that not everyone just can go into his little hole and say, I have a jolly nice life in my little hole, and the rest of the world can do what they want. Après moi le déluge. I don't care about it. We can't. The moment we grow into the 6,000 and 7,000 year period in our consciousness and span our consciousness, then naturally we have to take on us also the universal sin. And have to work it out that even the universal sin has no claim on us, just as Jesus did. Perhaps you remember of Mrs. Eddy, that once, I think it's in Collectania or in the Divini Course or anywhere there, that she said that she has to work out now the sins of the student. That it isn't a question that she can heal herself. But that she said, you know, I feel on my body the sins of my students. You know, the whole last 20 years or 30 years was just that. You see, she had that terrible church to build and to establish, and all the dumb thing that happened in that church, and everything always went wrong every other day. Huh? And so she felt that on her body. That's why she went through very difficult nights and very difficult days with a lot of pain and everything. And she said, well, that's all right, because now I have to work out sin, and not only sickness, the sins of the world, the sins of the church, so to say. Until she could, or I don't know if she could finally work it out. I don't think she could. to be absolutely untouched by it. We cannot say the spiritual is individual and that ends here at the nose and here in the back. It only happens within that, between the feet and the head and the nose and the back of the... That's not the realm of the individual. Where I say, if I have right ideas and do the right things, then within that individual thing, everything goes right. We have to do with ideas, and ideas are universal. So all that goes against the idea is sin in the world. And it's broken law. And broken law brings penalty. And we have to get free of the sins of the world. That's why one feels sometimes, you see, that one says, well, why am I so depressed today? Why I feel so, today? Nothing really has happened. We are quite happy and everything goes well. Well, not everything goes well in that world. The whole world is burdened by fear. By fear of the future, by criminality, by terrorism, by bankruptcy, by corruption, and by everything. We live in the atmosphere of the world. We don't live in an atmosphere where we just take in the air and breathe it in our lungs, and that's that. It's the whole atmosphere of the world, and therefore we have to handle that thing. It's a most interesting passage, as it just says, broken law brings penalty. She doesn't say, your broken law brings you penalty. That's the individual. We have to see that finally we live in a whole universe of spiritual ideas, in a whole universe of love's idea and love's plan and love's purpose. And before we don't see that right through, like Jesus, we can suffer under the world. We don't need to. That's clear. We don't need to. But that has to be handled through prayer, as she says it here. And also, she says, this helps us to go higher, to go up higher. So let's take all those attacks in the world, those depressing news and thoughts in the world. Let's take that as an opportunity to go up higher. And perhaps this evening I can show you a little bit how to go up higher even in this world of today. Yes. Okay, so this would be that fourth prayer of principle. I think each one of us can do then the developing sequence all by himself. We just go further and take the subject of life. Life, prayer of life, is a most interesting one. It's that prayer which puzzled me most when I was studying the subject of prayer, because I had expected something very different than what is stated here. And if we come to life, we start out with the first sentence, then I stop for quite a while. The first sentence says, petitions, so these are the prayers, petitions bring to mortals only the results of mortals' own faith. I think with this sentence at the beginning of this prayer, she gives the clue for the whole prayer, indicating really that there is a law of cause and effect. Namely, that only that what the petitioner has in his thought, in his consciousness, whatever that is, no matter if it is belief, or if it's holy faith, or if it is understanding, whatever he has, petitions bring to mortals only that, which only the results of mortals' own faith. That's interesting. Insofar as she brings out here that circle of life, which says whatever we flow forth, that returns to us. If we show forth blind faith, we get something back that is of the same nature. If we bring forth understanding, what comes back to the source is understanding. There is that circle that does not just go out forth and then has somewhere an effect. It's much not a linear thing of cause and effect. We always think very much of a linear happening of cause here that brings forth an effect. But it shows there is a cause, and what it brings back is that cause. The effect is the same thing as the cause. Petitions bring to mortals only the results of mortals' own faith. So the question therefore then will be, what is mortals' own faith? What nature does that have? What is in our faith? Is in our faith just blind belief? Or is it holy belief? Or is it understanding, truth? This is interesting. You know, in philosophy they have a good example. They say rain always makes street wet. When it rains, the streets get wet. And so you can see there is a cause leading to an effect. But when the streets are wet, you cannot say it rained, because perhaps it was just sprinkled. Or perhaps the snow did melt and the streets got wet. You see, there is not always congruency between cause leading to effect and effect leading back to the cause. The cause can be a rain, the streets are wet. The streets are wet, but the cause may not be rain. Whereas in science, you have that circle that it only brings back its own effect. You cannot have a cause which brings an effect and then say that effect is from another cause. Cause and effect are one in science. But it also gives us a sense that if we have an effect like healing, that does not yet say what the cause is. The healing may have a cause in a drug. The healing can have a cause in a mortal's belief. The healing can have a cause in blind faith. The healing can have a cause in understanding.